Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live and video streaming over Ustream.tv. Search for Gary Null from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. This is a special series on fascism, the role of media and education in the creation of an authoritarian fascist state. My guest today is Professor Henry Giroux. Professor Giroux holds the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster's University in Ontario. He was previously the Waterbury Chair Professor at Penn State University and Director of the Forum in Education and Cultural Studies. He is a leader in the field known as critical and public thinking, a term that describes the nature of spectacle in our news media, in our body politic, in our corporate education. He's a prominent advocate of radical democracy, which opposes the powers of neoliberalism, corporatism, and religious fundamentalism that is now diminishing our population's sense of civic virtue and free thought and well-being. And he has also been named among the top 50 educational thinkers of the modern period. He has authored many books, his most recent being Disposable Youth, Radicalized Memories, and The Culture of Cruelty, as well as Twilight of the Social, Resurgent Publics in the Age of Disposability. His website is henryagiroux.com. Nice to have you back with us today.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. I'm going to begin by giving an overview of some issues that involve fascism that most people would not generally associate with it, but indeed based upon how large corporate interest working with policymakers within our government agencies, both federal and state and local, are able to work an agenda to their advantage, almost always in secrecy and always against the best interest of the population. All of these are from current, meaning today's, news stories that are not promoted by the mainstream and, for that matter, not even the liberal media, because too much of the liberal media is funded or backed by corporate democratic foundations and interest, and therefore where they're willing to take on those policies or individuals within the Republican or conservative position, they're not willing to look honestly at neoliberalism or globalization or privatization that has occurred under Clinton or Obama or foundations that they are associated with or could get funding with. In other words, there's a third rail, and hence they intentionally stay away from that. But here are some of the issues that do impact us right now. The whole idea of privatization. Now, what are the things that they're privatizing that can impact us? Well, how about water? One of the most important things in the world is water. We have to have it. But we have had numerous instances that have been well documented about water privatization abuses and failures in California, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, New Jersey, Texas, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, just about anywhere it's been tried. Meanwhile, corporations have been making enormous profits on a commodity that most of us believe should be free. In fact, the biggest culprit is Nestle. They buy an enormous amount of water, and they pay about 1/100th of a penny per gallon and sell it back for $10. Their bottled water is not much different from tap water, and worse yet, corporations profit from water that is polluted. And dioxin dumping Dow Chemicals is investing in water purification, and Monsanto has been accused of privatizing its own pollution sites in order to sell filtered water back to the public. We also have the privatization of the internet, the privatization of television, and the privatization of phones. We also have privatization of transportation, of banking, and what that means, as an example, the banking industry is one of constant deceit and depravity. And if you name a major bank, I can show you hundreds of lawsuits that they've settled for all forms of crimes that if you and I were held accountable for, we would spend the rest of our life in jail. So it would seem as though they also have enormous influence over our judiciary and our Justice Department. And in fact, was it not Goldman Sachs that designed the mortgage package to lose money with intent, a malice aforethought, for everyone except Goldman and Countrywide and Wells Fargo? Wells Fargo targeted blacks and Hispanics for unaffordable subprime loans, and HSBC Bank laundered money the tune of $800 billion for Mexican drug cartels, and GE Capital skimmed billions of dollars from his customers, and dozens of hedge fund managers have been guilty of insider trading, and Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase hid billions of dollars of bonuses and losses of loans from investors. They fixed the LIBOR scandal rate, and which was trillions of dollars, and they illegally closed on millions of homeowners in the robo-signing scandal. So that's a big one. And yet when we look, the Federal Reserve gave each one of the people I just mentioned, each of the banks I just mentioned, anywhere from $500 to $2 trillion of our money interest-free. They're the criminals. They cause the problem. They get bailed out. We don't get a penny. But that is one of the tentacles of fascism. We also have the prison system. And think of it this way. It generates $40,000 a year per person when you're in jail. Who makes that $40,000? That means that the more people who are paying $40,000 are going to be a big profit stream. So it's in their interest to privatize prisons, to increase mass jailings for drug offenses, especially with African Americans, that make up 13% of the population, but 53% of all persons who enter prison because of a drug conviction. And yet marijuana usage rates are about the same for blacks and whites. And so we have a massive incarceration rate, the highest in the world. They are privatizing education. The notion that charter schools outperform traditional schools is simply not true. In fact, Stanford University Credo study concluded that privatized schools were slightly better in reading and slightly worse in math, with a little difference overall. And then consumer protection. When you start privatizing consumer protection, you are in trouble, because that means that anything that the public uses that has been privatized, you never know whether or not it's really going to be safe. And then so that's just one aspect of that. Now, then there's another aspect that I'm concerned about, and that is that right now the United States government is doing all it can to destabilize and eliminate any populist government in South America and Latin America. That means that the governments of Bolivia, for example, and Paraguay, last year the ouster of the president, Fernando Lugo, a Paraguay, was aided and abetted by the United States government. And it was revealed later the role that Hillary Clinton and her State Department, the CIA, played in it. In Venezuela, they tried that. And in fact, any country in South America that advocates land reform, that advocates a higher standard of living, a better wage, that person or persons are targeted as official policy. And yet we do not call these people out. We do not look at the consequences of what happens. But that's another aspect. So I want to open with this idea. I'm sorry for the extended overview, but we're taking the whole hour on this. On our last Progressive Commentary Hour, I had Professor Norman Pollack for an extremely insightful conversation on the defining characteristics of authoritarianism and fascism in the United States today. And there's so many, from creation of a gulag of sorts, invoking terror in citizens of both internal and external enemies, the surveillance system, the harassment of citizen groups and journalists, the arbitrary detention and release. In one of your earlier books, after a decade ago, you wrote that, quote, fascism is not an ideological apparatus frozen in a particular historical period, but a theoretical and political signpost for understanding how democracy can be subverted, if not destroyed. So please unpack that statement for us in the context of how you are witnessing today's politic as a signpost that is destroying our democracy, and what, in your estimation, are the most critical signs in the U.S. today warning us that the U.S. has fully tipped into an authoritarian regime. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, I think one of the things that I was trying to say when I wrote that piece was that there are many commentators, particularly liberal and conservative commentators, who seem to believe that fascism was a specific historical moment that basically is over, that it can't be repeated, and that we can only sort of refer to it as a kind of historical legacy that we need to point to, but don't have to worry about being corrupted by. And of course, what I was trying to say was that fascism, basically the legacy, the elements of fascism can be renewed and can be reconfigured in different ways, and that what we see in the United States is, in fact, a new kind of authority. I don't use the word fascism, a new kind of authoritarianism, in which democracy is being subverted in ways that are enormously destructive and dangerous. And I think that what I had pointed to and what I've pointed to in the past are basically what I call a number of fundamentalisms that strike right at the heart of what a democracy is about. And I think the first one I'll call a market fundamentalism, and that is what we have in the United States is increasingly a form of neoliberal capitalism that is as savage as it is cruel, and basically operates off the assumption that every aspect of society should basically be driven by market-based values, reforms, policies, modes of governance, and ideologies. And I think that what we see under this market fundamentalism is not only an amassing of wealth in fewer hands, but we see all the commanding institutions of the United States now being corrupted and being taken over by the bankers, by the financial services. You've already provided a whole list of examples of how some of this has worked, or how it takes place, particularly in the banking industry. I mean, what I found very amusing was the case of HSBC, because, I mean, here's a bank that actually laundered money for terrorists, and nobody went to jail. And the argument was they were too big to fail. Yet you'll get somebody like Edward Snowden, who is basically, in my estimation, an American hero, who reveals the corrupt and anti-democratic practices of a particular government, spying on its people and collecting all kinds of information, certainly in a way that borders on being illegal, and yet he's on the FBI's most wanted list. So I think the contradiction becomes obvious, but I think that around this question of neoliberalism and market fundamentalism, I mean, what we're seeing is a society that is not only driven by what I would call the logic of disposability. I mean, anybody who is not a good consumer or anybody who dissents either is seen as marginal or is actually disposable. But what we also see is an accumulation of power bearing down on all the major institutions of society, in which any public sphere that is non-commodified basically is destroyed or undermined, whether we're talking about schools, whether we're talking about the media, whether we're talking about cultural apparatuses and so forth and so on. But I think that what I also want to make clear about around this particular market fundamentalism is this is not merely an economic issue. I mean, it's also an ideological issue. And the real question here is, in what way does neoliberal ideology function so as to create the subjects and the formative culture necessary for people to consent to their own oppression? And I think that what we see under neoliberalism is a kind of public pedagogy that works very, very hard to reinforce the notion that profit-making is the essence of democracy, that social Darwinism is the only way in which people can deal with each other, that the war in which everybody's at war with each other is the only acceptable mode of social relationship, that violence and the military are the ultimate, represent the ultimate ways of solving problems, and it goes on and on. I think the second fundamentalism, and I'll be very quick here, is educational fundamentalism. And I think that what we see in the new authoritarianism is an attack on critical thinking, unlike anything we've seen before. This is an attack on the very notion of reason itself. I mean, it's an attack on any vestige of the Enlightenment. You see it in a host of basically what I call anti-public intellectuals on the right who believe in creationism, who reject science, who are waging a war on women, who are doing everything they can to dumb down the curriculum. I mean, I want to go back to Snowden again, because I think that what most people missed in that episode was a comment that somebody from one of the intelligence agencies made about Snowden, and he said, what's troubling about Snowden is that he's part of a generation that is very savvy technically and have access to all kinds of knowledge, but unfortunately they question authority. And I think that's really at the heart of what ties together a whole range of conservative foundations, anti-public intellectuals, and others who really want to do everything that they can to eliminate any public sphere that could possibly promote any notion of critical thinking, any notion of dissent, any means by which young people will be able to question authority. And we see the idiocy that flows out of this attack, this educational fundamentalism, in every aspect of the culture, in celebrity culture, in the mass media, in popular culture. I mean, the notion that the Kardashian sisters rule, they now become the marker for how we understand our relationship to ourselves and others. And I think the third fundamentalism is, of course, military fundamentalism. I mean, we live in a society now that is entirely militarized. Almost everything from fashion to the language that we use to the social relationships that we engage in to the collapse between basically the military and domestic and domestic police forces. It's almost impossible to ignore that we now live in a society that is increasingly organized around the production of violence. So that the war on home is now, of course, the war abroad is now part of the war on home. That senator from North Carolina, South Carolina, Senator Lindsey Graham, recently said, we're all potential terrorists, and this is a war zone. And I think that commentary is perfect, because I think that the notion of war zone is really how we increasingly should be describing American society, whether we're talking about the southern borders, or whether we're talking about gated communities, or whether we're talking about the incarceration of African American and Latino young men. What we're seeing in the United States is the emergence of war zones in different places that are basically about keeping people out while in some way protecting the 1%. And finally, we have religious fundamentalism. I mean, that's another element of what I call the new authoritarianism, in which we have all kinds of religious fundamentalists, from right-wing Christians to right-wing evangelicals, who are looking for the day when the earth will come to an end, who basically believe in the most anti-intellectual, most reactionary ideologies regarding women, regarding young people, regarding science, regarding policy. I mean, when you have druggists claiming that they won't dispense certain kinds of medicines to women because they violate reproductive medicines because they violate their religious beliefs, you know you're in trouble. When you have a war on women being waged as it's being waged, and particularly in these right-wing states such as Wisconsin, especially in Texas, where the reproductive rights of women are not only under assault, they really constitute a war zone being led in the name of religious fundamentalists. So I think, I'm sorry I've gone on so long, but I think those four elements at least provide a starting point for what we see happening in the United States.
During the conversation last night, I noted a list of fascism's traits compiled by the political scientist Lawrence Britt in a 2003 essay published in Free Inquiry magazine. And there are two items I'd like to discuss, and then a third, which is not on Britt's list, that pertains to educational indoctrination, which is very rampant in the United States today. It's a whole intentional dumbing down of critical thinking. But two of Britt's characteristics are control the mass media, which can include regime control of licensing and economic pressures on media outlets, and the government appeals for media to advance patriotic sentiments. And the other is disdain and suppression of intellectuals in the arts, or in short, the suppression of the inherent freedom of ideas. So I'd like to begin with your thoughts about how today's mainstream media is becoming essentially a source of misinformation and deception, steered by either the government or those corporate elites aligned with government media strategy. And if you had it to describe the long-term mission behind mainstream media, where it wants to lead the public, what would it be?
I mean, I think that one way of understanding the role of the media is to go back in some ways to C. Wright Mills. C. Wright Mills was brilliant in talking about what he called the increasing role of the cultural apparatuses in American society. And what he was arguing was that these apparatuses are crucial because they produce, in a sense, again, the kind of formative culture, the desires, the identities, the subject positions that become compatible in many ways with various forms of authoritarianism. Individuals who are passive, who only believe in individual responsibility, who are divided around questions of ethnicity, race, and class, who have no vision of democracy, who believe that the market is the only template for organizing society in general. And I think that what we have seen, particularly in the last 20 years, but I think it actually began in the 1970s, at least in my estimation, with the Powell memo, who was to be the Supreme Court Justice, Powell, writing for the Chamber of Commerce, argued that the right has got to be able to engage in the mobilization of ideas. It's got to be able to create its own media. It's got to create foundations. It's got to create its own public intellectuals. It's got to create, in a sense, cultural apparatuses in which it can push market-driven issues. And I think that what it saw and what it was responding to was the horror of what it considered the 1960s, when in fact democracy was flourishing, when social movements were engaged in dissent, where young people were questioning authority, when the university was forced to reconsider itself as a democratic public sphere. And I think that basically in many ways they won that war. The right had the funds, it had the organization, it had the focus to basically concentrate media in relatively few hands. And I think that what we see now, as you've suggested many times, and people like Robert McChesney and a whole range of people have written recently, the media is basically an adjunct of corporations. The media does two things, in my estimation, or three things. First, it delivers basically audiences to advertisers. It does that. Secondly, it whitewashes conflict in every way possible so as to turn it into entertainment. And thirdly, it considers dissent a disease and a pathology and does everything it can to demonize those people who engage in it. So I think that what we basically see in the media today is a really highly organized attempt to basically accommodate the American public to the American empire. And we know how powerful it is, and it's also a global force. It's not just simply a domestic force. But I think that what needs to be understood here is that the role of the media has to be addressed not simply as an economic entity that exercises particular forms of political and economic power, but it also has to be seen as a pedagogical force, one that, in which pedagogy itself becomes central to the very question of politics. So I think around that question, around the question of the media, I mean, I think that's a starting point for sort of understanding the role that the media plays. At the same time, I don't want to argue that power now around the notion of any cultural apparatus is exclusively reduced to domination. I mean, I think we do see alternative public spheres emerging around the new media. We do see people operating in the margins and outside of the confines. We have your radio program. I mean, we have Truth Out. We have Truth Dig. We have, you know, a range of small but consistently growing alternative forms of media that are challenging this hegemony. I mean, this huge, dominant cultural apparatus that has become the most powerful educational force in the world.
One of my great concerns, Henry, is control the press through censorship of journalists. There is a blogger, Joseph Wolf, from San Francisco, who had to serve a year in jail for refusing to turn over a video of an anti-war demonstration. And Homeland Security filed criminal charges against Greg Palast for filming victims of Hurricane Katrina. And there remain suspicions still over the curious death of journalist Michael Hastings in a car accident in L.A. And then there is the famous incident of Joseph Wilson's accusations against Bush in a New York Times op-ed that led to the government retaliation against his wife, Valerie Plame. Then Chris Hedges, Daniel Ellsberg, and others filed suit against Obama for the National Defense Authorization Act. And they claimed that the act theoretically would identify journalists as abetting terrorists. And when a fascist regime silences or intimidates or threatens journalists in order to hide government activities, how does it impact the media in the nation as a whole? What are the long-term consequences and outcome when independent journalists become too fearful to investigate and publish stories contrary to the ruling party? Your thoughts?
I mean, this is an old story. and it goes right back to the McCarthy period, if not the 1920s. I mean, I think that although it's far more intensified, I mean, I think that what we begin, I think there are two things to understand here. I think that at one level, dissent has become synonymous with treason, and no democracy would tolerate that association. And I think it's a major index of the degree to which we have seen in the last 20 years, and most surprisingly, under Obama, an administration that absolutely fears intellectuals and fears the power of dissent. Secondly, I think that what we're recognizing is that as dissent, as the squelching of dissent migrates from the universities to now journalists and the wider popular culture, we're beginning to gain a measure of the kind of fear that I think these administrations have regarding the power of ideas. I mean, I think one side of this is that it certainly represents a crippling blow to any notion of democracy, but the other side of this is that it reveals basically how dangerous these ideas have become and how threatened in many ways these powers are by these ideas. So there's an upside and a downside, but I think the downside, whether we're talking about the attack on civil liberties, the National Defense Authorization Act, the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, all of these things now are so visibly fascist and totalitarian that it's very difficult not in some way to have people responding to them in ways that reveal the degree to which they're reproducing an authoritarian state. And I think that what we see in the United States is an empire that's dying in its ability to legitimate its own power. So I think that at some level, what this increasing repression represents is the disintegration in many ways of a kind of neoliberal hegemony that in the past has been so arrogant and self-satisfied that it really had to in any way take note of those who were waging war, or not waging war, who were basically dissenting against its most authoritarian injustices and tendencies.
One common feature of fascism that is frequently cited is the merger between government and private industry. And it's clearly evident today that Washington favors the bidding of Wall Street and the large multinational corporations over public demands and needs. And universities used to be the citadels of critical thinking and the positive radicalization of thought and ideas. In many respects, higher education served as a kind of social checks and balances to challenge the ethics and morals of the government and private action segment. However, this role of the university has eroded dramatically during the past, let's say, 30 years. And over these years, we are witnessing an increase in the corporatization of higher education itself. And higher education has been hijacked by private industry. On the one hand, we can simply say this is due to profit. Education is big business and nothing else. However, I'd like to hear from you whether there are more authoritarian agendas behind industrialization of higher education, such as creating a larger class war or the division of social classes into an elite, and then everyone else as drones.
Oh, that's actually a marvelous analysis. And let me begin with that and then move back. I think that what people fail to realize is that the universities may be one of the few public spheres left where the kinds of knowledge, skills, values, social relationships, pedagogies can take place in which people can actually be produced, in which people can actually learn what it means to be socially responsibly engaged, critical citizens. But I think that, again, we have to understand the attack on the university as part of the legacy of the backlash against the 60s. I mean, I think there are two things going on here. One is that the right recognized that the universities were potential centers of dissent and wanted to do everything they could to do two things. One was to rethink the way in which universities are governed, to restructure them so as to be modeled after corporate modes of governance, and secondly, to reorient the ways in which young people are taught, so as to impose a kind of instrumental rationality on them that basically made them stupid, that really simply, you know, prepared them to be low-skilled, overeducated workers, a subaltern class in a highly inequitous society. I think in many ways that's been the thrust of what we've seen. But I think that what's important here to recognize is the nature of the class and racial war at work in higher education. The attack on affirmative action, the attempt to basically create an entire generation of young people who are so indebted to student loans that they couldn't possibly work in public service, to increasingly create policies that in which universities are defunded so tuition goes up, so as to exclude generations of middle-class and working-class students who will no longer have any kind of educational opportunity. I mean, these represent an extremely intensified class and racial war that is being waged against young people in the United States, and we don't want to forget this. This is not simply about the instrumentalization of the university. This is not simply about dumbing down the university. And it's not simply about turning the university over to corporate interests. It's about creating a university that, rather than being a democratic public sphere, now has become a kind of filter for reproducing class elites in a world in which actually there's no room because they represent both a threat and a burden to what we might, that is, working-class intellectuals and middle-class intellectuals, to corporate interest.
You've written extensively about the commodification of our children and youth, particularly within our empire of consumption. How does the message of consumption shape the views of children about themselves and the way they relate to the world and our society? And in what ways does this serve an authoritarian or fascist agenda? In your answer, please provide some examples of this so
I think the commodification of young people really is an attempt to strip them of any understanding of what it means to be an active citizen. In other words, to be a good citizen in the land of massive consumption is to basically be a good shopper. I mean, as American society has moved from production to consumption, I mean, it also has reinvented the very notion of citizenship so as to strip it of any critical and ethical possibilities. The commodification of young people actually not only depoliticizes them in the most ruthless way possible, but as you know and have written extensively, it also basically is an attack on the very nature of what it means for them to be healthy individuals. I mean, I think in some ways it benefits the corporate state, the authoritarian state, to have people so overburdened by their own health, by questions of obesity, by all these neurological diseases, by sort of bearing under the weight of what I want to call a disimagination machine that makes time a burden rather than a luxury, that these young people are now so caught up in this age of commodification and the forces of commodification that they no longer are capable in many ways of being agents in the most capacious possible way. They're caught up in what I call the logic of survival. And that logic of survival basically serves the interests of a corporate state. I mean, but I also think that when you look at the way in which the forces of commodification work and the ways in which it creates new and unforeseen ways of disciplining the body and engaging intellectuals who were involved in this. I mean, for instance, we now have a host of psychologists, doctors, academics who now are looking at the neurological implications of and how they're measured for how people respond to certain goods. We have people going into the homes of kids who in many ways, like for instance Disney does this, Disney among others, one of the major industries that do this, they do ethnographic studies. They go and they talk to kids. They're in their parlors. They're in their homes. In some cases, as Juliet Shaw has pointed out, they're in their bathrooms. You know, watching kids, trying to get cues that they can use to in some way put together these attractive sort of advertisements that would basically lure kids even more into the world of commodification. We see it in schools. I mean, instead of basically teaching kids about health and teaching them basically about what it means to be active citizens, the schools are now plastered with advertisements in the bathrooms, on the buses, in the books. And the curriculums are increasingly shaped by corporate interests. In many ways, the corporations are coming into schools and they're getting naming rights to gymnasiums, controlling almost every aspect of that public space that really basically says, the basic message for kids is buy and sell or die. You buy and sell or you're not worth anything. So the whole issue of commodification becomes like a giant fog that sort of engulfs these children and so limits their capacity for leading a decent life, for sort of engaging their imaginations, or in a sense becoming critical citizens, that it basically, one would have to argue, is certainly one of the mainstay fundamentalisms of an authoritarian society.
One of Lawrence Britt's fascist traits that pertains to the government's disdain and suppression of intellectuals and arts, in short, the suppression of critical thinking and the inherent freedom of ideas, today is we see our elected officials surrounded by either an elitist privileged class of individuals with pedigreed educations who become moguls in private industry and banks, or non-intellectuals fully immersed in the business class. And if they are academics, their conflict of interest clearly point to their association and allegiance to corporate goals. The new Secretary of Energy, Ernest Monitz, formerly an MIT, is an excellent example of corporate shills who happen to have been a professor as well. And we also are witnessing a dramatic cutback in university curriculums, especially in the arts and humanities. And education has become primarily skill-based in curriculums to awaken students to themselves, are eliminated. To the mental skills, only those that allow for greater academic achievement. So please describe for us what you are observing today as the suppression of the independent intellectual, particularly within higher education, if you observe this occurring in the media also. All right.
Oh, no, I think we see it everywhere. I mean, it's particularly rampant in the universities today. I mean, I think that, you know, you see three things going on in the universities that are very disturbing, and that, in a sense, not only suppress dissent and create a very chilling climate for dissent, but actually make it make dissent in a way so passé that it seems irrelevant to a generation of young people who are being given a message in which the only thing that matters is either writing grants, getting credentials, or basically learning technologies that will allow them to be able to in some way take advantage of this new global imperial network of finance capital. I mean, I think that we see in the university three things are going on. One, the modes of governance have changed in that instead of being modeled after those kinds of democratic relations in which faculty, students, and administration sort of work together in some way within a project that expands and deepens the possibility of democratic education, the models of governance in the university now are business-oriented, corporate-oriented. Increasingly, CEOs are being hired to be presidents of universities. And the presidents of universities, in many ways, have become they no longer represent an ideal for great visions and ideas, as they did in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 40s. I mean, you don't have university presidents intervening in great social issues anymore. Now they simply become, you know, they're fundraisers. I mean, they're spokespersons for neoliberal ideology. They talk about corporate sort of academic partnerships. I mean, their vocabulary has been stripped of any vision, any sense of the possibilities that a university might have, it would seem to me, for democratic leadership. Secondly, it seems to me you have a university system that has been so de-skilled. Power has so shifted to the upper echelons of the university that over 70% now of university faculty are contractual labor. They're not tenured anymore. I mean, these are people, this is a subaltern class of labor that barely makes minimum wage, is overworked, teaches excessive numbers of courses, and really doesn't have time to engage in the kinds of power relations that would, in a sense, both challenge the university and advance what we might call its democratic project. So I think that as you create this subaltern class of intellectuals, what you basically have done is remove from the power triage in the university the power that faculty have to shape their own, the conditions of their own work, and to have some input into how the university works. Thirdly, students are now seen as clients. They're consumers. I mean, they're basically not seen as basically fodder. No, I'm sorry. They're basically not seen as absolutely essential for what it means to be educated, to expand the promises of a democracy. So I think around those three issues, what you have is you have a university project that is inimical to dissent, that does all that it can to minimize those courses and departments and parts of the university that cannot be translated immediately into profits. And coupled with that, you have the increasing militarization of the university. I mean, you have, you know, intelligence agencies now being recruiting students, paying their ways, providing scholarships, and at the same time not notifying the university that these are basically potential spies who are in the university. David Price has written about this extensively and brilliantly, as have many other people. So with the corporatization and the militarization of the university, there really isn't a lot of space for the university to define itself as a place where intellectuals can be nurtured, where critical dissent can prosper, where informed dialogue can take place. And I think that what's scary about this is not that people in the university are simply being fired. What's scary is that this highly depoliticized, corporate, militarized mode of education, it's becoming normalized. And what I think that means is that it's no longer questioned. And so you don't have to really fire a lot of people, although you do it once in a while to make sure that people know that, you know, if you step out of place, you're screwed, you can lose your job. But I think that when you're, you know, when you're basically working in a contractual arrangement anyways, and you can be let go at any time, you don't have to fire people. You just simply have to not renew their contracts. So I think that what we see in the university is some enormously authoritarian tendencies that do not bode well for what it means to create the formative culture to make a democracy operative. And I think that where that has become so successful in many ways that the move against dissent, the most violent, the most extreme move against dissent, has now moved not – it does not take place within the university. It takes place against young people who are protesting both within and outside of the university what the university has become. I mean, hence the really violent crackdown on young student protesters, nonviolent protesters, whether they're being maced, dragged by the hair, excluded from public space, forcibly excluded from public spaces. This is a message that is now being sent to students, but also being sent to faculty. Don't question authority. Don't step too far. Because the issue is not that you're going to be fired. The issue is that you're going to be violated. You're going to be met with repression, and you're going to be potentially jailed. And I think this is the message that we now see being sent to a whole range of journalists and a whole range of courageous whistleblowers who are basically making clear and making visible what the government is doing to undermine any vestige of democracy itself. I mean, I guess what I'm saying here is that violence has replaced, in many ways, simply the squelching of dissent by other means.
For the final segment of our program, I'm going to read some pieces that show how fascism and a police state and totalitarianism all coming together in our lives without us being aware of it. And I want your response after each one, all right?
Sure.
The first is from Lynn Stewart Paramore from Alternet, Shocking Ways America Leads the World. First, the most expensive place to have a baby. Having a baby is going to cost you minimally $9,775, and if it's a cesarean, $15,041. That's the most expensive place on the earth to have a baby, and yet we have more babies born with problems than any place else in any developed country. That's one. Secondly, obesity. The United States is ranked number one in the world per population in obesity, and Mexico is closing in on us, but we're still ahead. And according to the CDC, 35.7% of adults are obese, but over 70% are overweight. And mind you, you have to be overweight before you become obese, and 17% of our children are obese. More than two-thirds of all adults in the United States are overweight or obese. That, of course, leads to heart disease, cancer, and many other conditions, mainly pro-inflammatory conditions, strokes, liver disease. It all goes up when you're overweight. We also have more anxiety disorders than any other country in the world. Americans are simply freaking out. Research has looked at the prevalence of various types of mental illness around the globe and found the United States is the world champion in anxiety and depression. If fact, the World Health Organization's World Mental Health Survey found that a full 19% of all Americans experience clinical anxiety in any given year. Well, that means then that we have about 40 million adults that are suffering from perpetual anxiety, and yet we don't talk about it. We simply try to treat it in ways that would not begin to help it at all. In fact, the treatment is as bad as the anxiety itself. Then we have the most people behind bars. Our incarceration rates in the United States are ahead of Russia, Cuba, Iran, and China combined. The Center for Prison Studies shows that we lock up 716 out of every 10,000 people, as compared to Iceland, 47 out of every 100,000, compared to Norway, 71 out of 100,000. We at 716. And the latest statistics show that 2,239,751 people are currently behind bars, and of those, a high percentage are there for a simple possession of drugs. We also lock up more youth than any other country in the world, including Russia and China and Iran and Saudi Arabia combined, 70,792. And many of these, it's simply for being delinquent. We also use more energy per person than any place else in the world. The U.S. is the global leader in the amount of energy used per person. We get top billing in electric consumption. No one else is even near us in coal and oil consumption. The U.S. Energy Information Administration, Americans account for 19% of the entire planet's total energy consumption, yet we're only about 3% of the total population. So when you consider our lifestyle, the air conditioning in our homes, so the electric requirements for our home electronics, everything that we do more often than not requires some form of energy. And then we have two other uses, health expenditures. This year we will spend over $3 trillion on our health care system, yet there's not a single part of our health care system that actually prevents disease. We do disease maintenance. And as an example, we spend more per person in the United States on health care than anyone close to it, $8,233 per person in the United States. And Switzerland, it's less than $3,000 per person, and they're one of the more expensive ones. So what exactly do we get for being number one and spending the most in healthcare? Well, we had the most death by medicine. The number one cause of death in the United States is American medicine. This has been independently, repeatedly confirmed. I did a major study on this and published it. It's up on my website. It's called Death by Medicine. I only used official statistics and found that from bed sores, infections in hospitals, from improperly prescribed drugs, drugs that were properly prescribed but the side effects of the drug killed the people, from medical errors, all these things lead to about approximately 700,000 dead Americans, 9 million injured per year. That's more than heart attacks, that's more than strokes, and that's more than cancer individually. And yet there wasn't a single hearing, not a single news report, not a single story anywhere in the American media last year on this topic. So here's a question. How in the world could you kill more people, 700,000, in a given year? Let's just go by 10 years, that's 7 million people, that's medical genocide, and not a single hearing, not a single discussion, not a single dialogue anywhere in America on the topic. Now, to prove my point, I went ahead and sent over 15,000 copies of the report, fully documented, to every major journalist in the United States, New York Times, Washington Post, everybody got it, every member of Congress, every governor, all the leading scientists, plus every state legislator in every single one of the 50 states. Not a single response from a single person. That tells me that they were afraid to open that door, because if it was opened and this information actually came out, then people would question every one of the statin drugs they're taking, the coronary bypass operation, the stents they're taking, the blood pressure-lowering medication, the psychiatric medication they're taking, and the antibiotics they're taking, the hospital procedures, the hospital stays, and why this is all happening, and why aren't we addressing it? Because this cuts across both ideological left and right lines. Both Democrats and Republicans support the industrialization of the medical industrial complex. because it's the number one advertiser on television. You can't turn on a television show, especially at night, without seeing a drug for something. But you never hear people talk about how you could prevent that. The Surgeon General, U.S. Public Health Service is not there to say, you know something, we really could prevent this disease if we did this, this, and this. Not a word. And then finally, we lead the world in cocaine use. That's correct. We've got, we're right up there ahead of everyone else. According to the World Drug Report and the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, so we seem to be doing a lot of things that are self-destructive, distracting us from our real issues, distracting us from empowering ourselves, and yet we are considered exemplary. And I'm saying, well, Bill O'Reilly and others that support fascism and the police state without question and equivocation, if we're so exceptional, why aren't you willing to acknowledge any of the things I just mentioned, which impact virtually every American family there is? Your turn. And this will end out our program.
Gary, did you? Was that a question?
That was a question.
Let me try to unpack all of that, because I think that, let me move from the most general to the specific. I think the first thing that it does is it absolutely breaks through the myth that the United States is not only the most, the best democracy in the world, but that it has the highest standard of living in the world and provides that standard of living for practically everyone. I mean, this is the great myth of American capitalism and democracy, that we are a land of social mobility and equality and basically outdo every other country in terms of the services that we offer people. It's a myth. It's completely wrong. It's really exposed. And to expose it is, in fact, to raise fundamental questions about not only why the lie is being propagated, but in whose interest it is to propagate that lie. Then let me be more specific. I mean, I think that when you begin to cite all these figures, from horrible health care to the massive incarceration of minorities, to the war on drugs as a racial war, to the war machine and the damage that it does, we begin to see a couple of things fall into place. One is, this is a country racked by enormous inequality in wealth, income, and power. And that inequality is so intense and is so widespread. The gap is so enormous, and it's so destructive that it has basically killed in the United States any vestige of democracy politically, economically, socially, and culturally. It's impossible to call ourselves a democracy when you have 1% controlling almost all the apparatuses that make a society work, almost exclusively in their interest, and for one thing, basically for profit. Secondly, you have, with the destruction of the social state, which is basically what you've reeled off. I mean, you know, we're not investing in the social state anymore. You have the rise of the punishing state. I mean, so as the social state diminishes, you have a punishing state that increasingly finds more people disposable and is more than willing to put them in the school-to-prison pipeline, or to basically incarcerate them, or to lead them to their own wits to simply survive in any way they can, all based on the assumption that they're ultimately alone responsible for the problems that they face. Thirdly, I think that you have to address that the collective health of a society is in many ways a measure of how well a democracy works, and what it means specifically in terms of how well it works for young people. And we've become a country that no longer invests in youth. Youth are no longer at risk, they are the risk. Youth are no longer troubled, they're troubling. We've turned our back on young people, because young people are either commodities or they're basically disposable. We have no interest in making the kinds of long-term investments that would suggest that they can have a future better than the one that we occupy now. Fourthly, I think that we have to address in this authoritarian state something that we didn't see in the older forms of fascism, and that is a kind of rabid individualism, a kind of privatization of almost everything, and a kind of undoing of social moorings that in any way allow us to be compassionate and to be concerned about the fate of ourselves in relationship to others. This is a country that has degenerated into a culture of cruelty. And it's a culture of cruelty because it has separated questions of economics and politics and power from what I want to call social cost. Actually, social costs are a burden. We don't care how all of these things impact on other people. The ruling elite are basically concerned about, again, making money, the accumulation of profits, and the accumulation of wealth and income, and everybody else can simply drop dead. And I think under those circumstances, any country is going to degenerate in ways in which all the markers that would attest to what a healthy society is, whether it be from getting adequate food, shelter, basic liberties, health care, has degenerated so badly that we now look like a seventh world country. I mean, we basically bear the – we have entire cities that look like Beirut, you know, when it was part of a war zone. I mean, we have health care that's comparable to the worst health care in the most underdeveloped countries. And yet nobody wants to talk about this because the mythology of the United States as somehow being on the forefront of what it means to embrace a democracy that benefits everyone has now become normalized. But again, as I said earlier, I mean, I think this myth is becoming clear. We see it in demonstrations in Wisconsin. We see it in demonstrations in New York. We see young people reaching out to the young people all over the world who are absolutely protesting these austerity measures, which are really nothing more than the ideological justification for a police state. I mean, so you're right. If you really want to talk about how a democracy fails its people, just look at the way in which it addresses the collective health of a people and the social provisions that would be necessary to make that collective health work. I live in Canada. I have health care that is basically funded by the government. My taxes are high, and I have no regrets whatsoever for paying higher taxes. I have surgery. I pay nothing. I don't pay anything for my drugs. I walk into a doctor. I walk out. There are no bills. I just have to show my health card. This is what civilized societies do. But in a society that operates under the hand of a savage neoliberal capitalism, the question of civility and justice and care and compassion are basically liabilities.
Okay. Henry, thank you very much for being with us today. I think we've hopefully touched on the issues that make a difference to allow people to have a different perspective than what they would otherwise have. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for inviting me.
Professor Henry Giroux, his website is Henry A. Giroux, GIROUX.com. His latest book, Disposable Youth and Twilight of the Social. I'm Gary Knoll. This is a continuation of our series on fascism in the United States, and I thank you for listening. Now let's go in studio here for a few minutes, and Luann Panessi's just come in. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Wow. Interestingly, I got this email from someone. They prefer to remain anonymous because they work on Wall Street. And he said, 10 years ago, I saw you at the Javits Center with my mom. He says, I work on Wall Street, and by the way, your criticisms of it are quite justified. And he said, recently, I read a list of the 100 most influential people in the world, and you're not on the list. Yet, you've influenced more people than you're being recognized for. Over 52 million downloads on your shows and documentaries. He says, I have a sister in Pennsylvania. She said, you've been aired 2,000 times there, and you multiplied that by 2 hours of each documentary. That's over 4,000 hours, often in prime time in major cities. Do you have any idea, he asks, how many people you've helped in terms of having people getting on vitamins, changing their diet, changing their lifestyles? He says, I'm guessing you've contributed anywhere from $5 to $10 billion a year to the United States economy based on projection tools that I have in my office. And he says, for the record, as far as he's concerned, you are the primary national voice in the United States. That's nice to get stuff like that.
Well, thank you. I have no idea how many people I've influenced. I would have no way of knowing that. That's 2,000 airings, more or less, in the last year on PBS stations from the anti-inflammatory special, not just in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It was shown a lot in Philadelphia. I get the carriage report. Some of these, like Houston and Dallas and Philadelphia and Washington, Seattle, you never know how many people are watching. If it's in prime time, you might have, 200, 400, 500,000 people. It's how many times they play it that makes the difference. And over a period of time, people might have not been interested in the message, might become interested. And then hopefully they will find some part of the message to change. Let's say a person, most people are not going to ever make radical change all at once. They'll make incremental change. So even if it just means giving up coffee and going to tea, if it means giving up dairy and going to soy milk, rice milk, almond milk, if it means giving up regular bread and going to a whole grain, gluten-free bread, people choose their shifts in health gradually. And that's good, providing that they don't stop. They just keep doing it a little bit each week. So at the end of a year, without even being aware of it, you've made major changes. You've given up coffee and sugar and artificial sweeteners and fried food and trans fats and the french fries and pizzas and hot dogs and hamburgers, and you begin to appreciate the taste of what's good. And then one day, you're just a healthier person. And you don't remember where it all happened. There was no single ooh-ah moment. There was simply an evolution of consciousness. And that's what's important. You know, it's not important who gets credit for any of this. That's really irrelevant. What's relevant is, for those people who choose to shift consciousness and become more aware, then that's a person that's going to be more aware of other issues, including an issue like fascism we just talked about. You know, they'll be more interested in that if they've made other changes in their life and found those changes work for them.
It's interesting. There's always people that email me and say, why doesn't Gary talk about just vitamins again, as if that's all you ever talked about? But maybe they just didn't hear all the other issues that you've discussed.
I have always talked about everything.
Yes.
They may have only selected the issue of health. Look, we have between 5,000 and 6,000 brand new listeners every day, 7 days a week to this program. And we have over 40,000 readers of the articles every day. We've had 52 to 54 million downloads of just this program in the recent past on just one server. That's just one. We have 9 servers. So how many it actually is, I don't know. But what that's telling me is this, that people want change, and they're going to find the change if they want ideological issues, natural issues, personal health issues. They will find it in the mix. So if you only did one thing, if you only talked about vitamins, you only talked about diet, long ago you would have run out of stuff that was original and unique to talk about. And then how could you talk about a diet if at the same time our rights of freedom of choice on genetically engineered versus organic food are being challenged?
Right.
You have to, they're all interrelated. You have to deal with the larger issues of life.
People want to hear the truth, and the truth is often skewed, or it's sugar-coated, and it's, people want the truth, and you're giving people facts. You're giving people...
Well, we're giving people a different perspective on the issues of life, and a lot of people want to know that. And we're getting 2 million brand new listeners per year. That's an awful lot of people. Fox News, O'Reilly's not getting 2 million new viewers a year. So and we do it under the radar. We do it quietly. There's no need for publicity. There's no need for fanfare. I stopped giving articles and interviews 10 years ago. You know, it's not necessary. People exchanging quality information with each other in the real world, that's what's relevant. Thank you, Luann. Let's say hello to you, Therese Lead, who's standing by, and she's going to tell us what's relevant about her show today. Why should we listen to you today?
Well, actually, you're listening to other people today, because today is open forum, and the conversation goes exactly where they want it to go.
Great. You, Therese Lead, right now.